वैष्णव वृंद की जय। इस्कान फाउंडर आचार्य श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय। नमाचार्य श्रील हरिदास ठाकुर की जय। प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्री वासादि गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गौर गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंदर हर कुंद गिर गोवर्धन की जय। श्री श्री वृंदावन धाम की जय। श्री श्री नवरू धाम की जय। श्री श्री मायापुर धाम की जय। श्री श्री मथुरा धाम की जय। श्री श्री जगन्नाथपुरी धाम की जय। श्री श्री अयोध्या धाम की जय। तुलसी देवी की जय। भक्ति देवी की जय। गंगा माई की जय। जमुना माई की जय। गौर प्रेम नंदी हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय। श्री श्री बृहद मृदंग की जय। ट्रांसनल प्रसारम डिस्ट्रीब्यूशन की जय। श्री श्री गौरनिथाय की जय। श्री श्री जगन्नाथ बलदेव सुभद्र की जय। श्री श्री कुमारी द्वारकाधीश की जय। श्री श्री द्वारका धाम की जय। स्वामी वीर भक्त वृंद की जय। All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritam Naram Chaivam Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Dato Jayamudirayat Nasta Prayeshu Abhadresha Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Utamashloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Third canto, 30th chapter, text number 32, is it? Daivena saditam tasya shamalam niraye puman punkte kutumba Poshasya Ritavita Ivatura. Thus, by the arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the maintainer of kinsmen is put into a hellish condition to suffer for his sinful activities, like a man who has lost his wealth. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Militam Jena Tazmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitana Manovistam Stapitam Jaitam Bhutale Svayam Rupa Paramayam Tadati Svaparantikam. Prabhupada's purports indicate that secular law sometimes follows the higher order laws of karma, the laws of Manu, the laws which govern the universe invisibly for most people. And the indication is that if someone loses something, especially wealth, which is the most dear thing to just about everybody, then one laments because one becomes very attached to that wealth. One identifies very prominently with wealth. It's almost intolerable for a person who has wealth to sit in the second or third class section of a train or an airplane because they identify so strongly. So from the very beginning, Prabhupada used to talk about the folly of those who identify with the body, and quoting many verses like Yasyatma Budir, Kunape Tridatuke, Svadir Kalatadreshu Boma Ijadvi, Yatyatha Buddhi Salilena Karichit, and so on. And this verse, which Prabhupada especially was very fond of quoting when he first came to this country, was that people become very attached to certain things, especially their body, their kinsmen, and their country. Very attached and identify with, I am this type of person, I have a particular profession, I have a particular activity, a hobby, a love in life, I have my family, I identify with my country. And then it also says such persons also go to places of pilgrimage only to take bath, what don't associate with the saintly persons who purify the atmosphere of such places. So the identification of oneself with one's kinsman, although it appears to be, from most perspectives, a kind of innocent, normal thing to do, is actually a very dangerous thing to do. For example, many people who are involved in research work or involved in scientific work or political work are aware that some things are very wrong in their society. And their job, in part, at least the overview of it, of a politician might be, you would say, of a government person, is to raise the standard, to improve the quality of life, or at least to maintain a certain quality. And the same thing with those who are engaged in scientific research. They are supposed to create more remedies for diseases, and in general, make life more comfortable and easier and better. But when they are faced with the big problems that face everybody, the big social and legal and governmental problems that face everybody, they realize that they're practically almost powerless to do anything to change the way the world is, even though they could work for it. But it always usually just comes down to the fact that they have to maintain their family, because this is their source of identification. And if they start involving themselves in some group or in some organization that requires a lot of extracurricular time that they hadn't budgeted for, that takes away from their annual earnings, then they're not at all inclined to do it, but they just admit, well, I have to maintain my wife, my family, my existence, my activities, and things will go on this way. Otherwise, everything will become upset. So by identifying this way, in a seemingly innocent way, with the family, with the community, with the country, then things do not improve. Things do not get better. There's no spiritual purpose in life. So this seemingly innocent activity of maintaining a household is not actually an innocent activity. It's no more innocent than someone who is born into the world and speaks very sweetly with very cute, cawing words, but is actually being punished for millions of lives of previous karma, karmic activity, activity that hasn't been authorized. So what may look innocent is actually not innocent, because one sees from a higher perspective, from the Vedic point of view. And here Prabhupada is pointing out the fallacy of identifying with wealth. There's an interesting story that's often told in this connection about a man who is very attached to his wealth, extremely attached. And they say that people become wealthy who are novu rich, those who aren't born rich, by being very manipulative and very careful not to misspend anything, to be a little miserly. And in this way, they amass a fortune. So this man was particularly adept at not wasting anything. And the story takes place in India, where it's a common practice that different types of munis and rishis and sannyasis go from door to door to beg alms. Well, this man would steadfastly refuse to give anybody anything, any kind of beggar, any kind of monk or any sort of renounced person. And he instructed his children to also do the same. So he'd never part with anything, not a single pice, not a farthing or whatever they had in those days. Not an anna of grain, nothing. So he instilled this kind of consciousness in his children, such that they became even more miserly than he was. And they would even commit acts of cruelty to avoid giving anything to anybody. So it came to pass that the father passed away, and the sons took over his estate and maintained this strict, they built a big wall around their estate, very strict method of not giving anything in charity. So one day, sometime after the father had passed away, and they were sitting in their chambers, and they had this big wall around their house, and a young beggar boy who was only on one leg came walking by on some crutches, and he was begging and trying to knock on the door and trying to raise some attention to his condition, that he wanted some charity. So he was outside begging and begging and very persistent. And some of the neighbors began to gather around and sided with this boy that why isn't he getting any answer? Why are these very rich people being so cruel? So this went on for some time, and he was knocking and knocking, not getting any answer. And the neighbors were gathering more and more, and sometimes people do. Small groups of people in India, they tend to gather around and form a minor conspiracy. So this was developing, and then suddenly a holy man, an aged holy man appeared, one who is known to be very visionary and even had the power to see past, present, and future. So he stopped and witnessed this scene, and then he started to laugh. And he was laughing in a kind of almost hysterical but ironic way. And then people began to ask him, what are you laughing about? This is a very tragic thing that's going on here. This poor young beggar boy can't get any charity from such a big, wealthy family. So he said, yes, he said, the situation here is that this young beggar boy was actually the father of the three men that live in the house. It was him who taught them how to be so miserly, and this is his karmic punishment. So, in this manner, the world is working in ways that we do not see. What appears to be our wealth, we are separated from, and then we lose it, and then we have to take birth in some way that karma is acting and is punishing us, and we lose it. So we become very attached to these things, almost unknowingly. We become very attached to these things which are a part of us. This happened to me once. I was on an airplane, and I sat down, and I had to take my passport out to show it to the flight attendants when I got on the plane. It was some country where you had to show your passport, and I sat down, and there was no passport. So I started to retrace my steps, and I looked under the seat, and I went back, and I asked the flight attendants, if you see an American passport, please let me know. And I was in really big anxiety. Went back and forth, looked everywhere, because I was, you know, identifying. So I was in deep anxiety. This was about a six-hour flight from London to Washington. And so for about the first hour, I was going through every possible outcome in my mind about what would happen, how I would have to get a new one, and how I would lose my five-year visa to India, and how I'd have to get all new visas and get a new passport, and it would cost $50, and just big, big-time anxiety. And then I thought, well, hey, I'm a devotee. I shouldn't be attached to my passport. I'm going to just figure out everything I can do, and then actually it's better that I don't have to worry about this old passport. It's just so big anyway. I have to keep getting new pages put in every time I have to travel, and it's actually better to not have it, even though I'd have to go through this whole process to get a new one. Anyway, so I had completely resolved myself and just started reading one of Prabhupada's books to the fact that I wasn't going to have my passport. And as the plane landed and was taxiing into the airport, a girl who was sitting in front of me turned around and held out a blue thing that looked like a passport and said, "Is this yours?" Obviously, she knew it was because she'd been looking at the picture. And apparently, she was sitting on it the whole way. I had dropped it on the seat in front of me, and there it was. So, but at that point, it wasn't any different about whether I had it or didn't have it. I didn't care anymore. And, oh, that's nice. Krishna gave me my passport back. So without some sense of devotional service and knowing that we shouldn't identify with these things, the world is going on in such a way that people are completely misidentifying with material nature and with themselves and their family, with their body, and with everything that they consider to be theirs, their wealth, their house, their car, their airplane. So in this chapter, we're reading about the adverse conditions, description of adverse fruit of activities, it is called. How it appears that we can enjoy life, but actually we don't enjoy life. We get wealth, but it's taken away. We accumulate a certain amount of things in this world, and at the end of life, it is all gone. And we are taught that devotional service doesn't just mean becoming detached from and renouncing these things and walking around barefoot and not driving cars, but it involves getting involved in such a way that we can use these things like these cars and all these other big inventions in devotional service so that they will purify us. But we also find that in doing these things, sometimes it happens that we see devotees get caught up in so many things. I used to think it was kind of humorous. I mean, I guess it was necessary, but in so many countries, devotees, whenever they'd go out of the temple, just to go to the store or to go out and buy something, they wouldn't wear their devotee clothes. They'd just put on a coat and pants and a hat. And then in different ways, because we're using the material energy in the service of Krishna, sometimes we identify with those things. So sometimes they were afraid that people would see that they were devotees and not like them, or think that they were doing something that was unconventional or unfit for human consumption, something like that. But it happens. So the difficulty is sometimes, how does one maintain one's spiritual purity while driving cars and operating high-powered computers and going out and having to preach? Just even the very fact of having to go out and associate with those who are not spiritually advanced, one of the strictures is that one shouldn't intimately associate with those who are materialistically inclined. And even as I was indicating in the devotional life that we practice, sometimes Prabhupada said once that Krishna consciousness is the razor's edge, and we shouldn't be surprised as to how many people leave Krishna consciousness, but as to how many stay in Krishna consciousness. So sometimes that aspect is there, and we find that even in endeavoring very sincerely to do things, we found that Prabhupada would say, hey, you're making a mistake, you're doing something wrong. There was a group who got attached to very intimate association with Radha and Krishna. Prabhupada had to break it up. We were hearing yesterday about, there was one reading about some club in the London Temple who formed themselves into a club, and Prabhupada had it broken up. And there were a group of devotees who thought that Prabhupada and Krishna were one. Prabhupada had to break that one up. Once he wanted to disband the whole GBC because he said they were getting too centralized. So in very sincere endeavors to engage in Krishna consciousness, even then we find sometimes it is a razor's edge to know, when to draw the line or how to draw the line. So it's very difficult sometimes, even in Krishna consciousness. And as it is indicated here, even if one makes an error, and of course now we're going back to strictly material life, those who are involved in material life, but if one makes a mistake, like in the law, this is a kind of law that follows the higher order laws of the universe. But one apologizes, gives the stolen money back, returns the stolen goods. Still, one is not absolved from punishment. There still has to be some way. And this happens both in the secular law and by the law of karma. If one commits a sinful act, then one may escape the law of the land, but still the law of karma, the inevitable, what is it called, the second chance? There's the infallible justice of karma. There's no escape. However, we're instructed that by engaging in devotional service, karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajam, that all of the reactions, all of the accumulated karma, all of the accrued sinful activity that comes can be eradicated through the process of devotional service, and only through the process of devotional service. Even following the ways of prayaschita, of being redeeming oneself according to Vedas, does not mean that there will not be punishment or some difficulty in a future birth. So these laws are inescapable, and we've been given the blessing of devotional service, that there is a way by reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, by engaging in the Yuga Dharma of chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, by serving the devotees, by worshipping the deities, and by engaging in devotional service that is free from any ulterior motives, from any desire to do something to material or to gain something material, one will actually become freed. And once Prabhupada said, I heard him say this once, that he was asked about astrology and palmistry. And he said, oh, we don't care for astrology, we care for Krishna. And then someone asked him, well, what about the stars, and what about the lines in your hand? Don't they indicate the future? And Prabhupada said, yes, but when we clap our hands in kirtan, all the lines in our hand become erased. So the idea was that there are laws that govern our existence. But by engaging in devotional service, we become transcendental to those laws. And we may live a fixed number of years, or as Prabhupada said, we can extend that time by engaging in devotional service, or we may be able to extend that time. But the point is, by engaging in pure devotional service, these usual laws that apply are different. They don't act in the same way upon a devotee. And a devotee's life is different because he's cared for. He's actually cared for by the Supreme Lord. So one who appears to be innocent, and it's very easy to see that people are going about their lives in an innocent or maybe incorrect or bewildered way. They have to suffer under the laws of karma, under the secular laws of the world. And only by devotional service can they actually engage in something, in a process, which frees them. So there's a certain sense of urgency a devotee feels in engaging in devotional service, that everybody that is moving around, all the human beings, all the cars that are driving, it's just like the car, it's on a precipice and careening, sort of out of control, about to go off. But every living being is in that position, having a bad day, as they say. You know, the devotee sees that this is actually not the proper mentality to go about life in a kind of numb way, in an animal-like way, just trying to improve the basic four principles of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, that this is not healthy. So one who is practicing devotional service feels a sense of urgency that I have to catch these people before they go off the cliff. And for one who is busily distributing Prabhupada's mercy in the form of books, sees that for every moment that is not engaged in doing this, there's so many people that are falling off the precipice. That's the vision of a devotee, of a preacher, that for every moment that I'm not utilizing properly in Krishna consciousness, that many people are having to suffer or having to incur this bad karma. That's the vision of a Gostyanandi, of a devotee. He's always feeling this deep compassion for the conditioned souls. So when it is said by the arrangement, one is put into hellish condition, and it's mentioned in this chapter, I believe, in some previous purports, that the hellish conditions actually exist right here in the material world. It's not that you have to go a long distance to find them. They're very hellish. When Prabhupada was here in L.A., he had to go to the doctor, and he was complaining that the doctor was somewhere up in San Fernando Valley, and it was 50 miles away. He said, just to go to the doctor, you have to go 50 miles. And once when he was interviewed on TV in London, he was asked if we had a concept of hell in our religion. And Prabhupada said, this is hell. London is hell. It's always raining. It's always moist and damp. We never see the sun. So as it mentioned earlier, that these hellish conditions exist. And then one is taken away by Yamaraj, a very painful experience. We have to feel some compassion. What a dreadful experience to have to undergo 792,000 some odd miles in a matter of seconds of pain, great pain and suffering, and to have to do all kinds of abominable things to prepare for life as a very low-grade animal. So this is what awaits one, and therefore there's a great sense of compassion that there's an urgency that one has to solve these problems in the material world, not only individually but on a macrocosmic scale to improve the condition. Prabhupada said that if the wealth weren't dissipated so much, if the prominent people of the world, this is written in his books, spent even half of their income, just half of their income, that the whole world would be turned into the spiritual world. Just that little bit. We were calculating the other day how much wealth there is in the world. And every single person, if you divided all the wealth in the world equally among every man, woman, and child, 6 billion some odd people, can anyone guess what the figure would be, how much each person would have? Anyone? Guess. Just guess. $1 million. Anybody else? $1,000. One more. $100,000. Well, the first one was right. $1 million. Just imagine $1 million. How unevenly everything is divided. And if just 50%, even by the top, maybe 100 or 500 people, were given to a spiritual cause, what a great change would be effected in the world. Actually, Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavatam that one gives in charity, this is very good, and it comes back to one in equal amounts. Giving is better than receiving. But if one gives to a Vaishnava cause, if one donates to the Krishna movement, then that investment comes back by unlimited multiplication. Those are the words Prabhupada uses. Comes back by unlimited multiplication. So this is one of the ways in which one is absolved from karmic debt, giving of one's wealth. And of course, giving of one's money, one's time, one's mind, one's words are all prescribed in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So in this way, the Vaishnava wants to induce this giving mood, this mood of Krishna being the center, and somehow to give one way or another a little bit of one's energy, one's time, one's money, one's words to Krishna, and then gradually change the environment of the material world of acquisitiveness and create a sense of voluntary giving to the central cause of things. I think Ridhananda Maharaj was talking yesterday about the center collapsing. So devotees establish what the center is and teach people how to fortify it. And in that way, the world becomes a little more livable. So I'll read the verse again. Daivena saritam tasya shamalam nidaye puman punkte kutumba poshasya ritta vita ivatura. Thus, by the arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the maintainer of kinsmen is put into a hellish condition to suffer for his sinful activities like a man who has lost his wealth. Comments or questions? Yes? We fear of offending and therefore we don't enable the movement to improve and progress. Was that your question? It's a good and devotional sentiment to not offend anyone. And the Bhagavad Gita teaches us that our speech should be satya priya hitam chayat. It should be truthful, but at the same time it shouldn't offend anyone. So it's kind of a razor's edge. And in general, our mood is not to offend. And we try to act and speak in such a way that no one is offended. But at the same time, satya priya hitam chayat, one should speak the truth. So it's difficult to know. One of the ways that we determine what the right course of action is to consult. Prabhupada writes in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, purport to the 35th verse of the first chapter of the Adi Lila, that one must consult with others. And he mentions the Shiksha Guru, the Diksha Guru, and of course Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu are our main principles of consultation. What course of action do we take? And if we do this, if we consult, Prabhupada says consulting is very important. If one refuses to consult with others, including a spiritual master, one at once becomes an offender at the lotus feet of the Lord and cannot go back to Godhead. So the main thing is to not think that we can act independently, but to know that we're living in an interdependent world of devotees, and all of our actions and all of our speech affects other people in a very intensive way. It's like a network. So this is the course of action. We should rely upon getting instruction from those who we look up to as our spiritual superiors. If you consult with those who you consider are more spiritually advanced to you, the best thing is to follow their advice. That's the best. That's the safe way. Yes?
So, in Bhagavad Gita, high things are discussed. Supreme Personality of God, and it's a word of nature, time, and activity. So, Prabhupada, if somebody remains in the mode of goodness, he can change the reaction of the karma. So, how it is it was applicable to the, in the case of Bhishma Dev?
How is it applicable in the case of Bhishma Dev?
How did
you...
Yeah,
Huh. Okay. Well, actually, Bhishma Dev was engaged in devotional service. And when he was stricken, apparently stricken, he was doing so by his own will, because he had been given the benediction to die at will whenever he wanted to. So when he was on the lying in the bed of arrows, Draupadi was kind of smirking, a little laughing sardonically, a little sarcastically. And she said, "Why didn't you defend me? Why did you let them try to denude me, the Kurus, in the assembly? And now you're speaking words of Dharma. Everyone is listening. Arjuna, Krishna, they're all hearing. And yet, so naturally, I feel it's a little hypocritical. So that you're speaking like this now, and then you didn't come to my rescue." So he said, "I was in their company, and they were maintaining me, and I thought that I had to do what they said, and I was eating their food, and because I was eating their food, my whole system became contaminated, all of my blood, and everything about me. So now I have no blood left in my body. And I think that all of this sinful activity is drained out of me, and therefore I can speak Dharma." So that was what he said to her. That was his admission that, you know, there was some problem before, there was some contamination, but that he had, by understanding who Krishna was and by engaging in personal relationship with him, that he had overcome that sinful reaction. Any others? Yes. It's very dissatisfying. I'm sorry, if you're saying someone is endeavoring with material. Yeah, motivated activity. A devotee's motivation is more than one. One is to become a pure devotee, to go back to the spiritual world at the end of this life. So that's a kind of motivation. Another motivation is to remain always under the lotus feet of Krishna, irrespective of what type of birth, even if one has to be born as an insect, as Bhaktivinoda said, "If I can be born in the family of devotee, that's my ambition." So to be transcendentally ambitious is not actually the same as being materially ambitious. Materially ambitious has as its goal to get material happiness, irrespective of whether or not Krishna is involved. And devotional ambition is to become a pure devotee, which means Krishna is always involved. It means that I'm always eternally Gopi Bharatara Bhadakamalama Nudasa Nudasa Nudasa. I'm always eternally the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna. And my desire, my other ambition, is just somehow to remain under the lotus feet of Krishna, even if I don't get to the spiritual world in this body, even if I don't get liberation. If I can just remain engaged in the loving service of Krishna, if I have that ambition, that's actually the renunciation of my personal accoutrements. That's the renunciation of illusion. So that kind of ambition, to give up illusion, is not actually materially motivated. It may appear the devotees are working very hard, moving around, operating machinery, but it's not material. It just looks that way from the outside, because their ambition, in one sense, is to show themselves and everyone else that they're using these things so that ultimately they don't have to be there. They don't have to be used, because our real life is not there. But because we are in the mode of trying to liberate as many people as possible in this short lifetime, in this Kali Yuga, we're using so many things in the service of Krishna. Just like we were hearing today about the axe handle and the tree. The axe blade. The axe blade says, "I'm very sharp, I can cut you down." But the tree says, "No, you can't do it unless you take part of me and then do it." So this was the principle that Prabhupada gave us, that we can work very hard in the material world, and we can use the same facilities in the material world to so to speak, cut it down, or cut down the material misconception that this is mine, this is my family, this is my job, this is my accumulation, this is my world to exploit as I see. These are the people and the animals and the plants and the air and the water to use up as ever I see it. So these are not material ambitions. They may appear that way, but that endeavor is actually an endeavor to renounce the material world and use it in the service of God, of Krishna. Thank you. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.
Will you wear it? For how long? 10 minutes? Okay. You have to wear it though. Otherwise, it's not fair, okay? What's your name?
Radhika.
Radhika what?
Radhika Dasi.
Radhika Dasi.